today, and welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here at HeritageRadioNetwork.com in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Whole Foods Market, and they remind you that every bite has a story. So whether it's a tomato, a muffin, or a T-bone steak, your conscious food choices can change the planet. Because at Whole Foods Market, every single purchase you make helps us support things like animal welfare, organic agriculture, equitable trade, and energy offsets. Let's think before we eat. Let's retake our plates. Whole Foods Market. Today's episode is with Kenji Lopez-Alt of, is it kacuisine.com?
that actually is has been kind of dropped. So yeah. I did have a small catering business called KA Cuisine for a while. The website is still up, but
it's still up, and you're still hireable if need be.
If the money is right, I'll do anything. Yes,
we're gonna hold you to that. You know that's gonna be on air. Well, Kenji actually went to MIT for
architecture.
Well, prior to that.
Prior to that, I was a biology major, yes.
And then eventually moving into...
Switched into architecture.
And
graduated and became a cook.
Yeah. Because degrees are worth it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
right. But in Boston, Kenji worked at...
Clio. I worked at Number 9 Park with Barbara Lynch, who is now a gigantic restaurant empire. She's just all over the place now. But when I worked with her, it was just Number 9 Park, which is now her, you know, one of her flagship restaurants, as well as at B&G Oysters and The Butcher Shop, which are her second and third restaurants. And then I worked at Clio with Ken Oringer. Clio is also, you know, another sort of Boston landmark restaurant.
He's also grown an empire recently.
Yes, he has also grown. I think he's up to 7 restaurants now.
I don't know. It feels like the two of them are just these fountainheads.
Right, yeah. They're definitely the big boys on the Boston scene.
Oddly, I was actually in Boston at the same time going to school and photographing in restaurants, most specifically Number 9 and Clio. I kind of was quiet, shy, and just there to document, so I didn't interact with the chefs that much. But oddly, Kenji and I may have... cross paths.
Yeah, probably did.
But oddly, we sit here today to talk about similar scopes and similar directions of what we do with food. After working at Number 9 Park, Clio Uni, you worked as an editor at Cook's Illustrated magazine.
That's right. Yeah, I started at Cook's Illustrated magazine as a test cook, developing recipes, and I was there for about 3 years. When I left, I was an editor there, and now I work for SeriousEats.com, which is a website based out of New York. Where our goal is to make everyone's lives more delicious. I'm the managing editor at Serious Eats.
While working at Cook's Illustrated, though, it says that you acted as the in-house science advisor.
Yeah, well, I've always taken an interest in sciences. Obviously, I come from my father and my grandfather are both scientists.
In what kind of realm?
Grandfather's an organic chemist. My father is a microbiologist.
Yeah, so you know tons about ester chains.
Yeah, if I knew more about ester chains, I would probably not be a cook right
yeah,
now. But I came from a scientific background. I went to an engineering school, so I've always been really interested in science. After I worked in restaurants for a number of years, I became very interested in the science of cooking and the science of food. At Cook's Illustrated, that was a place where I really got to explore that a lot. And sort of apply that knowledge in recipe development and developing new techniques and teaching home cooks how to cook better by knowing the science behind what they're doing. And that's basically what I do to this day.
Yeah.
I write a column called The Food Lab on Serious Eats, which is also a book coming out in 2012 by published by Norton. The Food Lab is just all about. Teaching people the basic scientific principles behind, everyday foods. We'll talk about everything from the science of roasting a turkey to mashing potatoes to making a pizza crust to forming hamburger patties.
So it's not the complexities of food science as people think today, like molecular gastronomy.
No, it's nothing like that. Yeah, it's basically, it's even as simple as, what's going on at a molecular level when you boil a pot of water. Knowing things like that, knowing the whys and the hows of cooking, I think is really the best way to become a better cook, because once you know how things work and why things work, you're no longer really chained to recipes or chained to tradition.
Yeah.
You once you understand why it works, you can sort of develop your own techniques, develop your own recipes, and it really, you know, frees you up to be a little more personal and artistic in the kitchen, because you have the confidence to put your own mark on your food rather than being chained to a recipe.
And I'm assuming you err less too, because you could troubleshoot at that point.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Even say you're making a pizza dough, pizza doughs are so sensitive to, say, the heat of an oven. And if you know how it's going to react to the heat of an oven, and you see what's going on in there, you can sort of adapt what you're doing. And so my oven is on a high cycle right now, so it's actually cooking faster than the recipe says it's going to cook. So I'm not going to be chained to a 3-minute timer.
Yeah.
I know, okay, this time it's only going to take 2 minutes. So, you know, by knowing how things work and why things work the way they do, you definitely end up with better food.
Yeah. We're going to come back to pizza, because Kenji didn't just use that as a random example. He's kind of obsessed with the food itself. But we'll definitely return to the idea of Kenji troubleshooting both Neapolitan and New York style pizzas. Mm-hmm. But you know what I find interesting? Like, Cooks Illustrated had America's Test Kitchen. I remember
right.
mm-hmm. watching that show, and you were involved in that show as well.
I'm in a couple seasons of that show. Yeah. I mean, I did a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and then I'm one of the co-hosts. I think it's 2009 and 2010 season.
Cool. Because what's amazing, it's the research that comes out of that show that is mm-hmm. actually seen on the screen, from recipe testing to equipment testing.
Right.
Because some of my favorite things are when they have three similar pieces of equipment,
right.
It like three different pans, and show the differences between that, rather than a lot of cooking shows where it's one recipe, one methodology, and this
right.
is how you do
right.
it.
Well, I mean, it's those recipes, you see them, and they're, you know, it's an 8-minute segment on the show, but what you don't see is that it takes one person 2 months of research and writing to come up with that recipe. I worked on a pie crust, I think it was in 2007, that appears on the show. It's in Cooks Illustrated also, but it's basically a pie crust where part of the water is replaced by vodka. And the idea being that gluten, which is the protein matrix that forms in water when you mix flour with water, you know, it's the thing that gives bread structure. If you have too much of that in a pie crust, the crust becomes leathery and tough. But if you don't add enough water, it's very difficult to roll out a pie crust. So the solution is to use alcohol, because you can form a pliable dough with alcohol, but gluten doesn't form in alcohol. And, you know, it's such a simple trick, and once you hear about it, like, it makes it sound so obvious. But to arrive at that point, it took me 2 months of work. I went through 148 different iterations of pie crust before I actually arrived at that final.
How many bottles of vodka?
Yeah, a few more than I should have had.
Yeah, a few in the pie and a few for yourself.
Right, right.
it's fascinating that you take these things for granted, and then you see how complex simplicity is.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any other examples, like mashed potatoes or something, that you spent months upon?
Mashed potatoes. I actually just did a couple recipes for SeriousEats.com, which you can find. They went up last week, so if you go to SeriousEats and search for mashed potatoes, you'll find them. But I'm doing a whole bunch of Thanksgiving recipes right now. But mashed potatoes, I mean, there's so much science behind a simple potato. From the ratio of starch to pectin, from the ratio of starch to sugar in there, and you know, all these things can sort of affect the way it can affect the final outcome of your potatoes. So, you know, something as simple as cutting a potato into quarter inch cubes instead of boiling them whole will give you a completely different end result, just because when you cut it smaller, more starch gets washed out, so your potatoes become a little bit less gluey. One example, the other recipe that took me a really, really long time to do was perfecting French fries. I'm talking about the sort of McDonald's style fries, you know, thin golden brown, you know, sort of the ideal McDonald's fry, thin golden brown, super crispy on the outside, nice and fluffy in the middle. And French fries just seem like such a simple thing, but you know, they're really, really difficult to get right.
A double brine and double fry.
The result I ended up getting was, if you boil the potatoes first in, uh, in, in water. So if you boil potatoes in water, they soften. The insides get a little fluffy. Eventually, they break into pieces. And the idea is that you want to boil them in water first just to get that center nice and fluffy, and to also wash away some of the excess sugars and starches so that when you fry it, it doesn't brown too fast. It turns nice and crisp instead of getting dark brown. But if you boil the potatoes in plain water, they get really soft and they break apart. So what I discovered was that if you add a little bit of vinegar to the water, what vinegar does is it lowers the pH of the water. And in lower pHs, pectin, which is the sort of cellular glue that holds, you know, that holds plants together, pectin doesn't break down as readily in low pH environments. So if you add a little bit of acid to your water when you're boiling your potatoes, you can boil them until they're tender, but they don't break apart into pieces. So that was basically how I solved that problem. So
yeah.
You boil the potatoes in water, and then boil the potatoes in water with vinegar, let them cool, and then you fry them, and they come out.
Cool. Can you use a whole bunch of acetic acids, like lemon juice? And
any acid will work, yeah. I mean, I use just plain distilled vinegar just because it has a neutral flavor and it doesn't come out. Lemon juice would work, and any kind of acid.
So is that a similar fashion to why people poach eggs with a little bit of vinegar in the water?
That's a little bit different. Yeah, I mean, the putting vinegar in water, vinegar reacts with proteins in a different way than it reacts with pectin. Pectin's a carbohydrate. It's a type of sugar. But vinegar will cause proteins to denature. So basically, you know, a protein, if you imagine it as like a pipe cleaner, a wire that's all jumbled up into a specific shape. When you heat things or when you put proteins in vinegar, it causes those pipe cleaners to kind of straighten out, untangle themselves. And that's basically what's going on when you cook something. It's all those proteins are straightening out and sticking to each other. And that's why meat becomes, you know, more opaque and tougher when you cook it. And that's exactly what happened. You know, an egg on the molecular level is not that different than a steak. You know, it's basically protein and water. And so when you put an egg in slightly acidic water, that acid will help the protein set a little bit faster. So people put vinegar in water when they're poaching eggs because they want that the exterior proteins on the egg to set a little faster so that the shape is nice
when you're done.
Although if you're careful, you don't really need you don't necessarily need that vinegar in there. You know, some people actually find that it turns the eggs a little tough and gives it a bad flavor.
But, yeah. So I mean, of these little techniques that you've learned, what do you apply, even though, or what are ones that you don't apply, even though you know they work better?
You know, cooking is always, it's always a balance between what you're willing to put into it and what you want your end result to be, you know? And so even though I know that, say, if I'm cooking a steak, for example, I have a nice, like 1.5-inch thick ribeye steak. I know that the absolute best way to cook it is to slow cook it first, either you know, sous vide in a water bath or in a really low temperature oven, slow cook it, give it about 2 hours to come up to a perfectly even 125, 130 degrees, medium rare in there, and then take it out and sear it at the very end. You know, but sometimes I don't want to wait 2.5 hours to eat a steak.
And sometimes you don't have a hold'em mat ready.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Sometimes you're restricted by your tools, and you're also restricted by the amount of effort you're willing to put in. So, you know, that's why most people, even at restaurants, you know, most restaurants still cook their steaks over really high heat, even though it's not the optimal way to cook a steak. It gives you results that are really good in a very short amount of time. They're maybe not the best results, but for a lot of people, the time savings is worth it. And for me, most of the time, honestly, most of the time, the time savings are worth it.
So, I mean, these variables aren't huge from how you do it one way to a next.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're cooking. Sometimes the variables can be huge. But yeah, it's, I mean, in the end, it's all just a matter of, you know, it's just a matter of knowing what you want your end results to be and how much time you're willing to put into it.
So your book...
you know, sometimes I'll even use canned chicken stock as opposed to making my own.
Tisk. when the freezer runs out of space, I do the same thing, like, you know, upcoming holiday season. Uh-huh. But your book, the kind of subtitle, tentatively at the moment, is Better Home Cooking Through Science.
That's right. Yeah.
And you worked at, you know, these lauded restaurants in Boston. How is cooking in a restaurant different than cooking at home with these new applied methods?
Well, for one thing, I mean, cooking at home is way more relaxed. It's way more relaxed. It gives you more time to explore, first of all, you get to do your own thing, whereas at restaurants, basically, you do what the chef tells you, and that's it. You know, and restaurants, you know, they're all about efficiency, high output, you know, getting everything done as fast as possible, and you don't really have time to try cooking this fish 25 different ways.
Yeah.
Right. You have neither the time nor the money to do that. And you know, frankly, most people don't have the time or money to do it at home, which is why you should buy my book, because I spend the money to do it. So you don't have to,
to recoup some of those losses. Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, I mean, you know, restaurant cooking is very, very different from home cooking. Restaurant cooking is all about following orders, working well in a team, being able to execute the exact same thing over and over and over again. You know, if somebody orders the halibut on Tuesday, you know, Tuesday in February, they want to be able to come back on a Saturday in May and order the halibut again and have it be exactly the same as they remember it. So working in a restaurant is a lot about efficiency and following procedures. Whereas cooking at home, you get to do what you want. You know, if I'm cooking at home, I don't want to eat the same thing more than once a year. You know, I'm happy with turkey on Thanksgiving. I want to do something different every single day. I want to be constantly exploring new, new tastes, new cooking techniques.
But I mean, the ideas are still about consistency and efficiency of technique and methodology.
Yeah, I guess in the end, the way my book will be applied for a normal person, yeah, would be to be able to get consistently better results out of your cooking.
So, could we maybe talk about a little preview of your book? Because we had priorly been chatting about the idea of energy and transference of energy.
Uh-huh.
But we're actually going to take a quick break and let you ponder that.
All right.
we're going to take a quick break, be back with Kenji Lopez-Alt, talk about the transference of energy, and not to forget his love of pizza.
Yes.
you're listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here today with Kenji Lopez-Alt, upcoming cookbook author, amongst other things, the Food Lab series for SeriousEats.com, soon to be a book by W.W. Norton in 2012. We had just left, I'd kind of been asking about the idea of maybe some previews, maybe some juicy little tidbits from this book, and Kenji was actually talking about the transference of energy and how important it is and how often overlooked it is in cooking. Could you give us a couple examples?
Yeah, well, you know, with cooking, I think there's a sort of misconception that temperature is everything. When it comes to, say, measuring the temperature of a piece of meat, you know, then temperature matters. You want your chicken to be at 150 degrees. The government says 165. Yeah. I prefer it 150. You know, you want a medium rare steak to be at 130 degrees. But when you're actually talking about the process of cooking, you know, getting something hot, getting something from cold to hot, which is basically what cooking is, what much more important than the temperature you're cooking at is actually how much energy you're transferring to a piece of food. And so, by way of example, I mean, you know, for example, you can have a 212 degrees pot of boiling water, and that's 212 degrees. You throw a piece of food in there, it cooks pretty fast. You can also have a 212 degree oven, you know, and that's the exact same temperature, but it cooks much, much slower. So, you know, you can easily stick your hand into a 212 degree oven, but if you stick your hand into boiling water, you're going to burn yourself. You know, and so that's a pretty clear example that temperature, when you're talking about how fast things cook and how and the actual process of cooking, temperature is not the overriding factor. Yeah.
And I'd say people can try that example at home, but I wouldn't advise it. And another reason to buy Kenji's book is maybe he's done that for us just to make sure.
Right.
That's true.
You know, you can have another good example at home is if you have a say a stone or marble countertop, and then you have a cutting board, and they're both sitting there at room temperature. Touch the wooden cutting board and it feels sort of warm, but touch the marble countertop and it feels cold. And that's because, you know, again, it has to do with a thing called thermal mass, specific heat capacity. And basically what that means is that certain materials, for a given temperature they're at, they have the ability to contain more energy than other materials. So that's why if we go back to talking about pizza a little bit,
I don't mind that at all.
That's why if you have if you go to one of the real Neapolitan places with wood burning ovens, you know, the air in the oven gets up to 1,000 degrees, the stone floor of the oven gets up to 700-800 degrees. But stone is not that great a conductor of heat, whereas metal is. So what you can do is at home, if you heat up a metal pan to 500 degrees, you can actually cook the bottom of a pizza crust just as fast or even faster than the 700 degree stone oven of a real Neapolitan pizza oven can cook it. And that's because, you know, again, temperature is not the only thing that determines how fast things cook. It has to do more with how fast energy is transferred from one place to another. And metal is just much better at transferring energy than stone is.
And most recently on Serious Eats, you did a couple posts of both Neapolitan and New York sliced pies and have been telling me the cast iron method.
Right. Well, yeah, the this is a method that that you use to get sort of Neapolitan style pies at home. And the way you do it is you make a basic Neapolitan dough, which is a lean dough. It's just flour, water, salt, yeast. You let it sit ferment overnight or for a couple nights preferably, then you stretch it out, and basically what you do is you heat up a skillet. It can be steel, it can be cast iron. You heat up a skillet to about 500 degrees, so that's maximum heat on your stovetop for maybe 5 minutes or so. And then you place the dough directly in there, top it with your sauce, and then slide it underneath a preheated broiler. And so what you're doing is you're getting it with the residual heat from the pan underneath, and then both the infrared and the convection heat from the broiler element above, and so you end up cooking the pizza in about 2 minutes, which is exactly what you want with a Neapolitan pizza, because these 1,000 degree Neapolitan pizza ovens, they cook pizzas in about 90 seconds to 2 minutes or so, and so you get when you cook them that fast, what happens is the air inside expands really rapidly, so you get a really dramatic rise in the cornicione, the crust, the outer crust of the pizza.
In the what?
Cornicione.
How do you spell that?
Cornicione.
This isn't a spelling test, but I think it's a great piece of knowledge for future food crosswords.
I think that's it. It's the Italian word for the pizza bones, the rib, the last outer 1 inch of the crust or so. But you know, you get that nice rise, and you get the leopard spotting that you're looking for in a Neapolitan pizza. But if we're talking about New York style pizza, those actually cook at a much lower temperature. They cook in regular, you know, they cook well in either coal or gas ovens. These days it's mostly gas ovens. But
that's like regulatory in New York because
you
can't have coal outside of John's.
Unless they're grandfathered in. But those ones cook at a lower temperature than a Neapolitan oven. And so the pies actually take, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes or so. And so those you can actually even just do in a regular home oven with a pizza stone built in it. You want to put that pizza stone in there because it absorbs energy and holds onto it until you put the pizza crust down on it, and then it transfers it to the bottom of the crust and gives it that nice crackery browning. And the trick to New York pizza is that the dough is a little different. The dough has a bit of oil in it, olive oil, which what that does is it sort of coats some of the flour granules so that they don't form as tight a gluten matrix, so the dough is a little bit less chewy and it's a little more tender than a Neapolitan dough is, and then it also has a little bit of sugar in it, just to help with the browning, finally, the one trick that I found really helps making any kind of dough is to make it actually in the food processor instead of with the dough hook stand mixer, because what that does is it goes really fast, obviously. So it breaks up the flour it breaks up the gluten into very small pieces that can then recombine into long strands. So you get a dough that can retain more air and it can inflate better, so that you end up getting a much lighter a lighter dough with a bigger hole structure. And doing it fast in the food processor, it also prevents oxidation. So the more flour comes in contact with oxygen, the oxygen can actually change its flavor profile. and so doughs that get kneaded for a really long time actually have less flavor than doughs that are kneaded with a lot of force very quickly. So food processors actually, as long as you're working in small batches, you know, it's not practical for a place like Roberta's to knead all their dough in a food processor. But for a home cook, it's really the ideal way to knead any kind of bread dough.
Excellent. Well, this is all the more reason to check out this book, because you think pizza is simple until you hear about this. But at the same time, it is simple.
It is simple.
This actually simplifies the best pizza you can make.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the idea is that, you know, for a lot of people, you know, for me for a really long time, you know, pizza was this magic thing, right? Like, I don't know how yeast works. I don't know how doughs work. I don't know what's going on there that makes this pizza taste so good. And the idea here is to sort of dispel that magic. There is some sort of magic in food, but there's no magic in the process by which food gets cooked. And you know, knowing the science behind that process really, you know, frees you in the kitchen. It makes you into a better cook.
Yeah, the magic is once you can produce the food that you want to eat.
Right. Yeah, the magic is between the people eating it and the food.
I just wanted to note one more thing that Kenji was actually named 40 Big Thinkers Under 40 by Food and Wine recently.
Right.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Also,
thank
you. Brendan and Chris of Roberta's were amongst that list. Mm-hmm. So it's just nice to have this community burgeoning with ideas and, you know, different tastes. And where do you see the New York or Brooklyn food community going?
I'm impressed by the number of the number of young people getting into cooking and wanting to do everything themselves, and that's had both good and bad results.
Yeah.
But I think it's fantastic that people really want to get to the roots of their food and are not content with the products they're given, and people want to really, you know, they're not happy just to put soppressata on their pizza. They want to know how the soppressata is made.
Yeah.
They're not even happy with that. They want to know how the pig that goes into the soppressata is raised, you know? And I think, you know, the more background knowledge you have about your food, you know, the more control you have over it, and the better you can make it in the end, and the better we can make the whole food system. So that's a very exciting thing for me.
And very exciting to have you on, discuss all this, build a better pizza. The Food Lab coming out in 2012. Always on SeriousEats.com. Kenji Lopez Alt. One other quick question. Mm-hmm. Background on your name. I mean, it's it's quite muddled.
Yes. My full name is James Kenji Lopez Alt. My mother's Japanese. My father's American. So that's the James and the Kenji. I've always gone by my Japanese name. I got married a year ago, took my wife's last name. So my Alt became Lopez Alt.
Yeah. Excellent. So Kenji's just bringing America together.
Right.
That's all we got to say about it. Thank you again for being on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Scene. Tuesdays, 3 p.m. Listen in. HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Durkel. And build a better pizza. Check out the Food Lab. Thanks.